Hello and welcome to another Mission Health Partners podcast. Today, Dr. Knox of Mission Health and Dr. Starnes of Carolina Hand and Sports Medicine talk about tendinosis. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast.
Well, Dr. Starnes, I want to thank you for being with us today with Mission Health Partners. My understanding is that you are an orthopedic surgeon, specifically a hand specialist working with Carolina Hand, that you've been with this group for about a year, but you've been in the Asheville area a little bit longer. We're so glad to have you in our community and would just love for you to introduce yourself a little bit more to those who may not have met you yet.
Yes, my name is Thomas Starnes. I'm a physician with Carolina Hand and Sports Medicine. And just a quick correction there, my training is not in orthopedic surgery. My primary training was actually in internal medicine, but I did a fellowship in sports medicine, which can take a lot of different paths. A lot of that for me has revolved around non-operative care of orthopedic problems, both chronic and acute, in the office setting. And as well, looking at some minimally invasive ways to try to treat some of these problems that don't involve out an open surgery.
Thank you so much. Yes, I didn't realize that Carolina Hand employed internists, so that's great that you're a sports medicine person coming from an internal medicine background. That I'm sure that gives you an extra breadth of experience and perspective as you treat these patients. So just to overview what we hope to cover today, we are covering tendinosis, and you in particular have a procedure that is minimally invasive that you would like to teach us about. That's an alternative to an open surgical approach. So we want to cover just sort of the natural history of these tendinoses. I'd like you to tell us about which particular tendinoses that you're seeing and treating. We'd like to talk about those anatomical considerations, any biologic considerations going on in the tendon, just to take us back to medical school and how we think about this. We'd like to talk about epidemiology. Who are these patients? What are their occupations? What are the use or overuse things that might bring these patients to you? Who is seeing them before they see you? What can some of those primary care folks think about in terms of prevention, either from sort of a iatrogenic consideration, medicines that might be harmful that they might be thinking about as they go about their regular care of these folks, any biomechanical concerns that they could be advising folks about, as well as sort of comorbidities, any sort of exacerbating conditions or medications. And then we'll get into diagnosis and treatment consideration. So that's my outline for today. And of course, anything else that you would like to teach us, we're happy to learn about. So does that sound good?
That sounds great. Just guide me through it step by step, and I'll give you the best answers I can.
Okay. Well, so in background, it sounds like you're really talking about tendon-related pain being a really common consideration. So please, let's just start with a typical patient that you have in mind that might be coming to see you.
Sure. So I think there's multiple facets to that, because you think about some of the more chronic or more common tendinopathies. I think some of the ones that immediately come to mind are lateral and medial epicondylitis in the elbow, which seems to run a wide spectrum of patient types. Laborers, I see a lot of people with mouthing injuries from computer work. So a lot of chronic repetitive motion there that causes that. I'll see people from a little bit more of like an athletic background, not always though, who have an Achilles tendinosis. And there's the thing that really got me thinking a lot about tendinopathies and tendinosis in practice is when I came out of training, I would see a lot of lateral hip pain. And where I was trained and just in practice, a lot of times the answer was to call it trochanteric bursitis and inject it with a steroid. And I would see these people in follow-up, or they'd had several injections somewhere else, or I had injected them or something, and they would get these temporary amounts of relief from a steroid injection. But the problem kept coming back, and it led me to just try to do a deeper dive into why this is happening and you know, why this isn't getting better. And I think what's often called bursitis is often an underlying condition of a tendinosis. And so I would say specifically with the hip, there's probably a more a classic presentation of a female above 60 years old who just has this chronic lateral hip pain, worse with climbing stairs, worse with getting up out of a seated position, and just doesn't get better despite multiple steroid injections.
And so that's really interesting. And are you getting these folks who not only have done some injections, but have they tried physical therapy and or tried sort of strengthening surrounding muscles and that sort of thing?
So I think that's a big, hopefully, point to raise here is that oftentimes I think physical therapy hasn't been tried. And because again, if you assume that the diagnosis is bursitis, a lot of times the reflexive thought process is, well, you know, calm down the bursitis and the pain will go away. So, you know, and it does for a short time, but, you know, typically around 2 months or so, people's pain is right back to where it was. So I think that's a point that can be emphasized just as a medical community is the importance of quality physical therapy and having a relationship with a physical therapist that you can trust and that you know is going to do a good job for your patients. I think that goes a long way, and I think that's always, in my estimation, that's first-line treatment for these problems, in addition to rest. But proper loading of the tendon can go a long way towards helping these problems.
Okay, that's great to know about. On that subject, any other sort of preventative things that that primary care folks should keep in mind as they make these PT referrals or as they're treating other comorbid conditions?
Sure. Yeah, I think comorbid conditions have to come into it. I think especially if you're seeing, you know, like an enthesitis or, you know, bilateral symptoms or in conjunction with other symptoms, it always can raise the question of whether there's an underlying inflammatory process going on. I think that's, you know, not common, but it's out there and we see that. So even getting some basic blood work, non-specific labs to look for inflammatory markers at ESR and CRP, just to see as a screening lab, is there something potentially underlying this that's causing this? Or, you know, just going through the patient's history and recognizing, oh, you have a history of psoriasis. Well, you know, enthesitis can be kind of a presenting symptom of psoriatic arthritis, and you know, so just being aware of those things, and medications go along with that too. The classic one, obviously, is fluoroquinolones, and you know, there's not a lot of good epidemiology on tendinosis because it's such a hard to define thing and hard to capture thing. A lot of it, I think, goes undiagnosed, but we do know that fluoroquinolones, ciprofloxacin, I think in particular, I think about 2%, up to 2% of people who are on ciprofloxacin can develop likely an Achilles tendinosis, and that can put them at risk of rupture, which is, you know, what we learned in medical school. So yes, being aware of some of those underlying comorbidities and medications can make a big difference.
Thanks, and forgive me, it's been a while since I practiced primary care, but is there a temporal relationship between the prescription or the administration of the quinolone? Is it concurrent symptom, or is it like, could it be weeks or months after the administration of that drug?
It's generally a pretty quick onset. I think the average time from prescription to onset of that of the tendinosis is about 8 days. So usually pretty quick in onset.
Okay, thank you. And then back to the physical therapy subject, is there a particular duration that you feel like people should put in, or a frequency of therapy that's important to know about?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, and I think it's worth recognizing it goes a little bit into the histology and the biomechanics, I guess, of tendons. But tendons take a long time to heal. I think that's important for people to understand is it's not a quick fix. There's no quick fix for this. It's a process. And so if you look at some of the research that was first done by Alfredson looking at Achilles tendinosis, mid-portion Achilles tendinosis, the program that he described in the literature and has been validated was a program of eccentric training, loading the tendon through lengthening over a period of 12 weeks. So, right there, you're talking about a 3 month process of getting this tendon to heal. Tendons have a poor blood supply, and it is a slow process. So I think at least setting the stage where if you start somebody in physical therapy, letting them know this is not a couple of visits we're talking about. We're talking about you may not be specifically in physical therapy seeing your physical therapist for that length of time, but we're probably talking a 2 to 3 month process at minimum.
And for that particular tendinopathy, is sort of maintaining this program of eccentric loading, is that going to be something that person's probably going to have to do for months to years, if not indefinitely?
Yeah, I generally talk to people about getting through a program of physical therapy and kind of transitioning from a treatment to a maintenance phase of that. So you may be done, visiting a physical therapist in the office, but it's the important part of physical therapy, I think, is just as much the homework that you're putting in on your own. And so maintaining to once or twice a week, you're doing the exercises to keep that tendon strong.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. Don't want to jump around too much, but while we're, it sounds like we're kind of tending a little bit more towards diagnosis and even treatment. So we talked about physical therapy as not only sort of good for preventative, but for treatment. And wondering if you can talk a little bit about sort of, say somebody still has these, is struggling in this dimension after pursuing a pretty robust physical therapy program, is that the point that they should refer to a specialist like you, or what would you advise?
Yeah, I think that's certainly a good point when you failed or a patient has failed physical therapy and conservative measures. And I think an important part of that too is understanding that a lot of these tendinopathies happen in the context of overuse. So recognizing that either modifying activities or refraining from aggravating activities can be an important part of that too. So rest is a huge part of getting these to improve as well. But certainly if they've been through a course of physical therapy and not improving, I think that's a good time for a referral to a specialist. And it's a clinical diagnosis certainly, but that's I think a good point in time to think about imaging as well, because you can take a look at this with ultrasound. Ultrasound technology is getting better and better where that we can start to recognize these problems under ultrasound with using Doppler. You can see if there's been neovascularization and ingrowth of these abnormal blood vessels into the tendon. You can see on ultrasound if the tendons appear disorganized and unhealthy. You can also start to appreciate as well if there's, you know, partial or more significant tearing of the tendon, and in which case that kind of changes the game plan quite a bit. If there's extensive tearing of the tendon, in many cases, it probably doesn't matter how much physical therapy is done. If the tendon has a high-grade tear, it probably needs referral to one of my surgical partners to think about getting that tendon fixed.
And is this an ultrasound that I, as a primary care physician, could just order and assume that any ultrasonographer would get the kind of study that you want? Or is this more of a bedside procedure that somebody like you would be performing in your office?
Yeah, more of a bedside procedure. I think it's nice to be able to do that and correlate it clinically with the patient right there. Patients appreciate seeing you know, that pathology right at bedside and being able to go over that. And that's a nice benefit. I think, you know, certainly another option that that's available is MR. Obviously, there's a little bit more cost associated with that, but it does a very good job of evaluating and seeing, you know, is there tearing in the tendon. It kind of gives you a little bit more, I guess, complete picture of what's going on with the tendon as well.
And that's a non-contrasted study, I assume?
That's correct, yes. Yeah, okay. I don't see a situation in which I would use contrast.
Okay. So it sounds like for the purposes of efficiency and value, that rather than order an ultrasound myself, I would just refer to somebody like you, and then you could either perform the ultrasound or get the study that you feel would be best. Is that safe to say?
I agree with that. I think that, yes, that would be appropriate.
Okay. And then sounds like one of your minimally invasive things you could actually do right there at the bedside with ultrasound guidance. So I'd like to hear a little bit more about some of the treatment options.
Sure. So, you know, treatment options with this kind of span the spectrum, right? Again, I can't emphasize enough that rest and physical therapy take care of the vast majority of these. And tendinopathies, again, the vast majority would tend to resolve within, you know, 3 to 6 to 12 months. It's for those patients that this is just an ongoing struggle and it's just not improving, that we have some more options. And so, you know, I'll let patients know, I never want to inject a steroid into the tendon. I'm always very cautious about that because, you know, steroids have been shown to further weaken the tendon. They decrease the load tolerance to failure of the tendon. So we always want to be very cautious with that, and you know, the big one that always comes up is the Achilles tendon. You know, don't inject around the Achilles tendon because it's prone to rupture. And you know, I think that's true, but other tendons are very similar in that regard. And so steroid injection can be an option, but I always want to have that as a guided injection where I'm cautiously placing the steroid not in the tendon. But I let people know it gets you some short-term relief, and it may be enough that you get some short-term relief where you can really maximize your therapy, and that takes care of it for you. But I think a lot of the studies show that while it gets you short-term relief, it tends to prolong the nature of the symptoms, and it can really make for a longer process for the patient. So I think as much as possible, often steroids are kind of falling out of favor with a lot of tendinopathies. Some of the other options would be some biologic injections, something like PRP or platelet-rich plasma. It depends on the literature you look at, but you know, I think especially for the common extensor tendon at the lateral elbow or lateral epicondylitis or lateral epicondylosis, whatever you want to call it, there's pretty good level one evidence for its use in chronic tendinopathy. And you know, we've had some good results with that. I think the downsides to think about with platelet-rich plasma are because it's not a standardized protocol. There's a lot of different ways to formulate PRP and a lot of different machines that do the work. And, you know, there's, again, not a standardized even protocol for how people do PRP. It's not FDA approved, and therefore is an out-of-pocket expense for patients. So that's a consideration, certainly, and that limits its use for some people.
Do you have a sense of what is billed, just a sense of cost on that?
Yeah, I think if you look at a range for PRP, again, it's going to vary significantly by geographic region, but you're probably looking in the range of $500 to $1,000 for a PRP injection.
And is that just a one-time injection, or are there typically multiple?
Yeah. People will do protocols where they'll do a series of two or three injections. My personal protocol, I like to do one and follow up and see how the patient's doing, because I don't want to commit them to a series of injections if it's not beneficial to them. And I also want them to and in many cases, they are having good benefit from that first injection.
Okay, thanks. Do you perform, or do you know therapists? It seems like something I've heard of, at least in the community, performing dry needling.
Yes.
What's your order?
There's some, and I think that can. My personal thought with that is a lot of this with dry needling is attempting to, in some ways, recreate an injury in that area, and to increase some blood flow to that injured tendon, and so there can be some benefit to that. I think it's probably helpful to know what that tendon looks like with imaging to think about whether that would be beneficial or not, right? So I think in terms of modalities, I think that the dry needling is an interesting one and can be beneficial. I think another one that really shows a lot of promise, and I've had some patients do very, very well with in terms of a physical therapy modality, is blood flow restriction, where a device is used to not cut off, but to restrict blood flow to that area based on the patient's blood pressure. And in doing so, it stimulates the tendon to release a host of chemical factors that give the body the impression that a heavier workout has occurred than what actually has. For example,
kind of like a stress test.
Able to lift a 4-pound weight, and it stimulates the experience of lifting a 40-pound weight. So you're not overloading the tendon with a heavy weight, but you are getting the benefit of that. And so, again, I think that's a really helpful modality.
Okay, great. What other modalities can you perform or recommend?
Yeah, so I think, one that is available for long-standing tendinopathies, right, where, again, you failed a lot of different options and things just aren't getting better for you. I think it goes back to a brief look at the histology of tendinosis. If we can just take a detour on that for a second. So a healthy tendon, if you think back to medical school histology, a healthy tendon under a gross section is gleaming white, glistening. All the fibers are packed in parallel on a microscopic level. The tendon fibers are linear. There's not a lot of extra ground substance in between the tendon fibers and the tenosites. A tendinotic tendon, that has changed, where I liken it to a rope that has frayed. The rope isn't torn, but the rope is frayed, and it's just swollen, and it's not as healthy as it could be. And the similar thing is going on with a tendinopathic tendon, where instead of the tendon fibers being packed tightly in parallel, they're wavy. There's increased ground substance. Proteoglycans are deposited in there, and that attracts water. So it's a swollen, unhealthy tendon. On a gross section, it looks dull and brownish. And so there's an obvious part of that tendon that it is not what it was designed to be. And so I think in those situations where somebody has those long-standing tendinopathies, and you can see it on ultrasound, and you can see that the tendon is unhealthy and the tendon fibers are spaced apart, an option for those people is to undergo a procedure called a minimally invasive tenotomy, where under ultrasound guidance, a small incision is made. Local anesthesia is done, so the patient's wide awake for this. And then an instrument's inserted into the tendon with the goal of debriding out the diseased tissue. It's a really elegant instrument that allows us to debride out the diseased tissue, but it leaves healthy tissue behind that selectively engages diseased tissue with removal of that diseased tissue. I think just as important with that for the folks who have that neovascularization seen on ultrasound is destruction of those blood vessels, because they're not really functioning blood vessels. But what happens with that is, you know, again, they're disorganized and not the typical blood vessels that would be seen in the peritoneum of a healthy tendon. But what comes with them is also ingrowth of nerves and that the pain signals. In many cases, are thought to be as a result of the ingrowth of those abnormal nerve endings. And so I think destruction of those nerve endings can play a significant role in that as well. And again, with any of these procedures, whether it's, you know, a minimally invasive tenotomy or whether it's PRP or you know, several other procedures that are out there, I think a really important point of that after the fact is a stepwise supervised progression of therapy, of stretching and strengthening that tendon. And I can't emphasize that enough.
Okay, that's great. And so this is a one-time minimally invasive tenotomy. This is a one-time office procedure, or after follow-up, is this sometimes repeated?
Yeah, no, it's a goal. And this is one that's done in an outpatient surgery setting. With again, local anesthesia, a small incision, you know, but whether it's a hip or an elbow, patients are able to walk out of the surgery center, which is pretty remarkable. It's a small incision that closed up with a Steri-Strip. So, you know, patients are really pleased with that. And yes, the goal is that it's a one-time procedure, right? Where we're trying to go in and remove the diseased tissue out of the tendon, leave healthy tissue behind, and then further strengthen the healthy tissue with appropriate therapy after the fact.
Okay. As a palliative care physician, I often think of, you know, the natural history of disease on a range, sort of a, some people getting no treatment at all, some people getting a treatment, and then among those groups, dividing it out between, you know, sort of worst case scenario, most likely outcome, and best or optimal scenario. So for both of those types of patients, a patient who might have pursued, you know, the physical therapy and then the and then whatever procedures recommended, whether it be PRP or minimally invasive tenotomy, could you walk me through sort of the range of potential outcomes and timelines?
Sure. So I think it's important, you know, right off the bat, to be honest with folks and say, you know, in many cases, you know, some of these patients were seeing, you know, hip pain for 20 years, you know, elbow pain for 10 years. And I think having a realistic conversation with the patient and saying, you know, listen, you've had pain for a decade or two decades. I'm not going to make that pain go away in 2 weeks. That's not realistic. But I think having an option for them where they can work through the therapy side of things again after the fact and recognize, you know, the goal is that you're starting to experience some pain relief, right? And even if that's a reduction in your chronic pain, that's an improvement and that's a win. But it may take, you know, certainly 3 to 4 months before you're doing activities where you're not thinking about the tendon pain anymore. And you know, you're going about your day and, oh, I didn't think about my lateral hip pain today. So, you know, I think setting that timeline is important.
And really setting the stage for a functional outcome as the goal. Okay. Tell me a little bit about costs for this procedure.
Yeah, so we talked about the PRP cost. I think, I think PRP is very effective in these, and I've had good results with that. The fact that it's an out-of-pocket cost is a barrier or a deterrent to some patients. The nice benefit to a lot of the minimally invasive tenotomy procedure is it's built through insurance. So as compared to an open surgical release, like for a lateral epicondyle, you know, the cost is improved because there's not anesthesia involved. You know, the anesthesia involved is some lidocaine. It's a local anesthesia, so that improves cost. Again, for some of these procedures involving the hip, you know, what used to be kind of endoscopic is now done minimally invasively. So the cost is improved, but you know, obviously everybody's insurance plan is a little bit different. But insurance, you know, will cover these, which is a nice benefit to patients.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like the more open approach would be about 3 times the cost of the minimally invasive therapy. Is that right?
Yeah. Again, yeah, I think it's going to depend on location and payer and everything else. But I think there's, you know, certainly, you know, an increased cost with an open procedure. And, you know, and also I don't want to make this sound like I'm disparaging open procedures. I think there's a place for them, right? There's a place for going in and debriding a tendon and reattaching the tendon. But I think these are some of the treatment options that, you know, that I and others like me can offer that kind of bridge that gap between an open procedure and a completely non-invasive procedure.
Great. Well, thank you so much. I'm so glad you're here in the community and able to offer this option. Is there sort of an ideal patient, or what's the referral process for us to get one of our patients to you?
Yeah, I think, you know, in terms of an ideal patient, I think, you know, someone who's suffering from chronic tendinopathy, you know, who's, I think, ideally tried some things. I certainly don't mind evaluating patients and going over a discussion with them and, you know, going over some imaging with them and saying, listen, you know, you haven't really had a good course of physical therapy yet. Let's try that first, because, again, in the majority of cases, that helps significantly. So I'm happy to see anybody that, you know, anyone in the community has a concern about a tendinopathy, that I'm more than happy to see them.
And this is upper, you know, both upper and lower. Ideal,
yes, right. So the majority, again, of what's been done is elbow, both, you know, lateral and medial epicondyle, and then lateral hip tendons, you know, gluteus medius, gluteus minimus. But yes, more than happy to evaluate anyone. And again, in terms of, you know, patient selection for who would benefit most from these procedures, I think I tend to reserve these procedures, and I think, you know, rightly so, for those who have failed more conservative measures first.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for teaching us. What more haven't I asked you about that you wanted to convey to us today?
No, I think this is a widespread problem. I see it you know, on a fairly regular basis. And I think just the importance of, again, getting people into a quality physical therapy program. I can't emphasize enough the importance of a good relationship with a physical therapy practice, you know, that benefits people. Yeah, I think one thing we didn't touch on, but across the spectrum, it's interesting whether it's upper extremity or lower extremity, just in terms of not necessarily demographics, but who gets tendinopathies. There's a definite association with obesity and overweight with developing tendinopathies, and I think we think a lot about that, and that makes a lot of sense with lower extremities. We think about load bearing in the Achilles and the gluteal tendons, but it's interesting that there's an association in the upper extremities as well, and I think there's probably a little bit more of a metabolic process there than what we currently understand, but keeping a healthy body weight is an important part of prevention.
Okay, well, thank you for that. That's very important for all of us, absolutely, to emphasize to our patients and try to promote as a public health priority of our community. So thank you so much. And thanks for informing us about the tendinopathies or tendinoses and potential treatment options. I hope you have a great day and thanks for this.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate you having me.